PID is MRO2395. That's Mother Robert Oscar 2395.
I wonder if we just start.
I guess so.
What did she say, pound?
Yeah.
This is Larry Doubleock and Quint Heckert, and we're going to transcribe the following biography of Larry Doubleock. And Quint Heckert will add at the end to fill in the holes that I don't get here. So to start this out, I'm going to try to follow the script a little bit, but basically provide a genealogy of my career and the programs that I've worked over the years and for the last 42 years. I was grew up and raised in northern Michigan in a small farming town. My grandfather was a first-generation Slovenian that migrated over here and ran logging camps all over Upper Michigan and settled on a 540-acre farm, which, with probably my best management training, working through high school with my uncle. And after high school, I joined the United States Air Force, and I was a meteorologist and worked in the South Carolina, Donelson Air Force Base, which now is owned by Lockheed Martin, and spent some time in Operation Deep Freeze 4 down in New Zealand and Antarctica. And I ran for 12, 13 months, I ran a section, I was a section head of a upper air sounding balloon operation in Korea. And I got out and worked for the Milwaukee Railroad for all the way through college as a brakeman, and went to Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan, and had a double major in math and physics. And when I graduated, I interviewed with IBM. They were looking for all the top people out of the school, so I was invited to interview with IBM Awago, which is part of the Lockheed Heritage Company, and I ended up going to UNIVAC. The reason I went to UNIVAC was I had a physics professor who happened to be a Lockheed employee who had retired and decided to teach school and enjoy the fine hunting and fishing of northern Michigan, and he kind of steered me. He said, you'll have a lot more fun at UNIVAC than you will at IBM because they're kind of structured. So I did the interviews, and he proved me right. It appeared to be a pretty structured organization, and at the time, UNIVAC was just growing. This is 1966, so the service test NTDS had been fielded, and the beginnings of the digital revolution were upon us. The split off with controlled data had occurred in the underseas area. The controlled data produced the digital fire control computers, and the Sperry, which took over UNIVAC about that time, produced the navigation systems, and the computers for that system were produced here at UNIVAC as well. When I got here, I was interviewed as for failure analysis with my physics background and math analysis. There was a lot of taking these old analog computers and converting them to digital computers, so they needed math analysis because digital computers didn't integrate too well, so you had to do a lot of algorithmic and table lookup work to get these things working on a digital computer. But I ended up my first job because they were in the chaos of a lot of opportunities, Spin 42 carrier landing systems. We had a minesweeper job, which is where I ended up on. And so I spent the first year working on that computer program. It was a 1218 computer, and was had all of the sensors, radars, sonars, or whatever. It was a gated radar with that you plow a field through the minefield, if you would, with these little reflectors and find the mines. And so we did that the first year. And about that time, my wife came to work, my future wife, that is, and worked in the same department, Jane Martin, who I later, in 1970, ended up marrying. And after that first year of that project, I ended up working in the mainstream of the NTDS program, and at that time we were defining the DLG 16 class and the 36 class, and putting together those programs. We had a control formatting unit program that interfaced all of this stuff to the first digitally integrated chip, the 16 class. And so I ended up volunteering, and I was selected as a literally 1.5 years into my career to integrate the ship at sea. The first Leahy, USS Leahy, it was in Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, and all of these brand new subsystems that included the first standard missiles, Sperry 55B radars, an ITT Gilfillan 3D radar, which is digital radar, which is the first digital radar. They were all in a ship, but they didn't work very well. So they hired a team headed by General Dynamics, who had built the first standard missile, and I ended up being the integrator because we had the computer and TDS system. So I got a lifetime of experience in the 3 months while we literally towed that ship to down to Norfolk and debugged it and crawled through spaces with oscilloscopes and tried to get this thing debugged and wrote several hundred ECPs, I guess, and finally went down and had some successful testing down in the Caribbean, and came back, and then we had 16 follow-on ships that I was the project manager of. So that kind of set us up for the knowledge of what was wrong with the developmental and integration thing with this new digital era of converting the stuff from analog standalone computers to an integrated solution for the warfighter. And so when I came back, they set me up as a supervisor of a new group called Systems Integration, and Quint Heckert, who is here with us today, was part of that group, and as I recall, it was around 1968 time frame, and within that summer, we literally won the Central Computer Complex integration job. Quint and the rest of the guys and myself put together a great big 6-foot wall chart that showed how we would bring all this together as an integrated environment. And so it started out as a $50,000 contract to look at putting a UIK-7, which was the new generation computer with integrated circuits, on board, and it was the first multiprocessor. Well, that first multiprocessor was problematic. I can remember sitting with the customer, Lieutenant Commander Tom Weisenberger, and bemoaning the fact that we had taken on a job for a measly $1.8 million to integrate a multiprocessor on a brand new class of fast attack submarines, the Los Angeles class. And at the same time, UNIVAC was running into problems with their first multiprocessor that they were integrating into the air traffic control reservation system, I should say, as the first multiprocessor, and they had burned up $100 million, and we were supposed to make the first thing work for a measly $1.8 million. Well, we did make it work. It was a matter of collaborative engineering between Naval Systems Command and Naval Ordnance Command and the lab at Newark, which still exists up there and we're still working with today. And we brought these systems together and put them on the submarine and saw the first commissioning of the first of that class. So that kind of set the tenor for our submarine work. This is in the 69 time frame. This was initialized. At the same time, they were looking at a new generation of Poseidon submarine. Remember I talked about the navigation computers, so Sperry had the navigation system on there. And we were looking at a brand new class of ship, and it was I remember calling it the PERT chart for ULMS. And so we decided we wanted to play in that game, leveraging off our Central Computer Complex exercise. And so we put together an IRAD program, these were folks that were in our IRAD group. This was Jim Ketchum's group and Phil Phipps and folks like that that we brought on board, Bill Cayley and some other folks worked on this thing. And we put together the whole another great big story for the Trident, hoping to repeat the exercise we'd done on the 688. But we were a little day late and a dollar short. We didn't end up teaming until the last moment, and we lost the work to team, Electric Boat being the prime, and IBM. So then we, and IBM was going to put 4Pi computers on it, and so we didn't like that very much. So we used our leverage to on the UIK 7 Central Computer Complex, and got on the IBM team, and ended up doing the software for the operating system and for a layer of system that brought these two twin multiprocessors together called TCP/TSP. In addition, during that time frame, we did the mission critical job, the most mission critical one on Trident, which was the ship control program. And we also, at that point, were doing the navigation system for Rockwell, under subcontract to Rockwell. And then under subcontract to Electric Boat, we built the software in a UF-20 computer for the ship control. And this is the one that hovers the ship while they fire the missiles. And it was done with model-based development that we had out of the model basin. And this was so well done that it sat on the shelf for about 18 months while the rest of the subsystems got pulled together. And when it finally got to be integrated up at Newark, they were having difficulties, so we volunteered to help the integration effort. Jim Peterson was at the forefront of that marketing effort, and we ended up putting John Byrne and a bunch of local hires that we hired. We eventually grew that group to about 30 to 40 people, and those people worked on the Trident, and they are part of our Lockheed Tactical Systems CSS organization, and they're still doing maintenance on those systems today. So this had long-term impact, and as I'll get to later in the game when I get back to working submarine stuff again in the 2000 era with the Common Radio Room, that will become apparent how important this was to Lockheed and the whole future of the evolution of the legacy systems. But I want to drop back a little bit to, we were doing a lot of fun things in the 70s with all the technology, and Jim Ketchum and his IRAD guys, they were working on the ideas for automating cars, something that was thought to be crazy at the time, but now is a matter of fact. Digital hydraulics and a lot of signal processing work in the sonar world, because that was a very difficult problem of doing what manual sonar operators had to do. So, yeah, that's where I'm going. And along the way, Quint Heckert was a part of that. Monty Widdows was the salesman. And Bob Dufault and Phil Phipps were in the basement with an old 1218 cut prototype computer with some Fortran algorithms. And we ran around the country selling those, trying to get somebody to buy off on that, and of course nobody was too interested in buying something. They had their big programs, the SQR-19s and the BTQ-5s and all that kind of stuff, but we persisted anyway. And at the same time, Red Phillips, who was the chief engineer, did something that was quite historic that's been lost in the annals of history. In 1971, he produced an open systems computer, meaning that he picked parts out of a catalog and for $100,000 built a desktop, basically, computer with two little racks and a 19-inch rack. One was a power supply rack and a little rack for the processor, full-featured new 16-bit computer that had been prohibited by Sperry management because, obviously, this was going to compete with their $5 million computers and just wasn't a part of the game. So he had Glenn Craigness, who later turned out to be the UNIVAC architect for all the later versions of 1180s and 1190s, et cetera, computer, and he sent him off with 100K of overhead, and he built this computer. Well, meanwhile, Monty Widdows was still trying to sell some signal processing stuff, so one day he walked into my office, and it was late August, and said, gee, I think... We just won a job. For $50,000, we're going to put a signal processing system to sea. We looked at each other, and Quint was there and said, gee, I don't know how we're going to do this, but in those days, you never said no. A contract was a contract, and you were obligated to perform. So the mission, the fog cutter is what it was called, we got a bunch of GFE analyzers, and we built things out of agate boards. Charlie Hare was a part of that operation. Bob DeFault and the guys in the basement took this signal processing Fortran system and put it in that 1616 computer, and we had a little display that would put the LOFAR-gram on it, and it was a band tracker, which means it could track the signals and the Doppler of these signals and make some sense out of the operator. And the government was experimenting with a linear array along the submarine as opposed to the dome arrays to get 3D kind of passive tracking capability. So this was the perfect thing. And then the opportunity was presented by Austin, Texas. The college guys had failed to produce the processing system. We're supposed to collect data out of this thing. So Monty came in with his 50K and said, you got 2 months to do it. Well, we did it. Quint Heckert and Charlie Hare rolled out of here on a truck and took this stuff out to Groton, Connecticut, installed it, and spent Thanksgiving out to sea or putting this on the thing. And it ran for the entire mission. They brought it back. They dumped salt water on it through a hatch and sent it back, and that computer ended up being a card tester at Plant 1. Significance of this to Lockheed Martin is that at about that same time, the government was deciding they needed to replace these 18-bit 1219 computers for fire control computers, because the story of the day was, if you were doing fire control, you had to have an 18-bit computer. If you were doing command and control, you had to have a 30-bit computer, and it was all part of the politics of whether CDC produced it or UNIVAC produced it or whatever. But so with the 8-bit bytes coming out on strong, the 16-bit computer was decided thing. So we bid that. Don Woodard, myself, were the systems guys on that, and I forget who all worked on it. I think Dick Erdrich and probably those guys were part of it that had worked in the 1616. And so that story ended up being the instruction set architecture for the militarized version of that, and that created the entire genealogy of the Yuk-20, the Yuk-44, for the medium-scale computers that we dominated, along with the Yuk-7 growing into the 44 computer, or the Yuk-43 computer, and ultimately into the Q-70 program that has been the mainstay of tactical systems here for the last 25 years. So this was a fun time, and so there were a lot of other things going on at the same time. Of course, in the commercial world, Jobs from the Mac invented the Mac, but if you'll notice, that was 1974, and as I indicated, Fog Cutter was in that 1616 computer, so we had the opportunity, a major lost opportunity, to get into the small computer market at that time. And but again, the poor business features of this company were more focused on doing stuff for the military and doing what the customers wanted us to do. We had a statement that said, "Sperry, we listen," and that meant that we did whatever the customer wanted us to do. And the business side of the aspect that has emerged with a mature company like Lockheed was not there at that period of time. The other sad part about that era of the 70s was 1974, they passed the Competitive Advocate Act. And the Competitive Advocate Act means you had to compete. Well, before that, we had literally a lock on all of the Navy computer business, both in the airborne and the submarines and the surface ships across the board. So the Navy ran a successor program to the air defense system that was NTDS, and they called it the ASMS system. So it was an R&D program. We teamed with our friends from General Dynamics, who owned the missiles and Standard missiles, and we lost to a company called RCA that happens to be at Moorestown, that has been the other mainstay of Lockheed Martin, which is the Aegis, which has evolved into a ballistic missile defense system that is par to none in the world. And it's kind of interesting to me, for my first experience in 1968, there were algorithms on there that would automatically fire those Standard missiles. John Hopkins University had algorithms with automatic track detection and classification that worked in those days. So the world has come a long ways from those rudimentary NTDS systems that are our history. So we went from 1974 to 1979, literally, and this unit didn't win a major program because we really just didn't know how to compete. The question was, what does the customer want, And the answer was, you get NTDS because that's what we're selling today. And we didn't know how to read shells and be responsive to customer needs and didn't know how to write proposals, et cetera. And this was a pretty dry time for the company. Meanwhile, in the underseas area, though, we were still plugging along and selling off stuff. We had all of the stuff that was the Trident production work was going on for the navigation systems that we did, the computers, et cetera. And at that time, we were starting to get in some IRAD for the next generation called SUBAX. I happened to be on a part of an NSIA committee, an architecture committee, and myself and Ken Pearson and others put together a big trade study for the next generation architectures, distributed versus federated, et cetera. And that evolved into a SUBAX competition, which we teamed with Rockwell, who we'd worked with on the navigation system. And we lost that to IBM, which is Manassas. And again, as part of the heritage story, that turns into the MS2 Manassas operation, and along with Syracuse, that has the entire command and control systems and sonar systems, which evolved out of that original BQQ5 central computer complex through a series of other developments, Mark 117, CCS Mark 1, etc. So when we launched on this, we had an excellent design based on our shin pads technology. We had a fiber optic shin pad solution with our Yuck 44 computers that was just a gangbuster solution, but they selected IBM and because they had the production facilities and capabilities to do with the BQQ5, and so they were a lower risk than going with these guys in the Midwest that had a spiffy design along with our friends at Rockwell International. Well, we did get a cut of the action because they did pick up and use the Yuck 44s, but they unfortunately used a packet switching operating system, and that packet switching operating system didn't work too well, as would have our direct memory access fiber optic shin pads evolution. That was a pretty proven and very efficient way to handle a distributed system that came out of this NSIA architecture committees that we were involved in at the time. So that was a big loss for us, but we ended up putting the 44 computers on there. At the same time, there were other things going on. The signal processing stuff had evolved, and we actually had built a series of parallel processors using AMD 2900 off-the-shelf processors. I believe Rick Martin was a part of that, and the first integrated circuit kinds of stuff. This is now in the late 70s, and so we looked at that for an application called EMSP, which is Enhanced Modular Signal Processor. And we put that in as our RFI offering, but the company decided that they were really in the data processing computer business, not the signal processing computer. And we were actually told by the Newick people that evaluated that that was the best proposal that they saw in terms of that parallel AMD 2900s chopping off these LOFAR grams and processing them at very high speed signal processing. And another follow-on to that is that that processor, after they shut us down in the signal processing effort, a couple things came out of that, because a couple years later, Sperry used that same AMD 2900 signal processor, became the foundation for the NexRad weather systems that are out there today. So a lot of connectors in terms of our legacy heritage of programs that are still ongoing today. At the same time, we were looking at the Mark 117 and CCS Mark II. This is now I'm up to about the 79 era. At this time, I was shunted up to program management, and I had a signal processing program called the SQR18, which we put on, which is a towed array sonar built by Edo, which turned into DRS Corporation, which we were teamed with on the Q70. So again, small world in terms of customer and the connector companies that went along. So we produced that one of a kind, but the SQR18 was outvoted by the big program, which was the SQR19 out of Syracuse, General Electric, again part of the heritage companies, and those programs are still going as well today. So we didn't make very good progress on that. By this time, we had decided to set up a new business unit. I was in program management, and so we set up a business unit called Underseas to take advantage of the growth and the opportunity was in that area. And, of course, there was a lot of manufacturing going on at that time with the UIK-7s for backfitting literally 100-plus submarines. And we had that work to do. We had a setup down at Norfolk and all of the places. We retrofit the 688, the 700s, the 637, and 594 backfit programs. At the same time, the new evolution of Trident was coming along. And so the new Trident computers were on the design boards. Sanders had run into trouble with the displays, so we ended up with that manufacturing. And by this time, in the 80 to 84, I was marketing manager and business unit chairman of this new Underseas organization that was over in building corporate square. And we had, I think in 84, we booked $100 million, which was Trident production and all of this stuff. So we were rolling pretty high, coming from a $15 million base 4 years earlier. And this was all at the behest of Jim Rappanack and Dick Seaberg. One of the questions in the interview here is, you know, what was the most people that affected the growth companies that grew into the legacy? And I would nominate Dick Seaberg as being one of those people that really made us grow, because after this drought in the late 70s, when he took over in the late 70s, we started winning again, winning the 43 competition against IBM Owego, and winning the next generation 44 computer, and starting to move out in strategic planning, cash flow management, and a lot of the disciplines that are here in the modern business world today. So those were fun years. Unfortunately, the saddest part of my career was when Jerry Probst, who is the other one I would nominate as one of the heritage companies that, along with Vance Kaufman, are probably top shelf presidents and CEOs that made things happen. Burroughs did a hostile takeover based on our taking our money out of our pension plan to buy the company, and we went into a period of 8 or 10 years where things were pretty slow. We went from this business, as I recall, it was consolidated as about $1 billion business unit at that time with Unisys, and we ended up with $350 million as a base after they had closed down all but one of our 8 factories and basically took the stuff to the bank. So in 1984, I had three salesmen here in St. Paul and two people out in the field tackling this $100 million business unit. And the next morning I woke up and I had one salesman left, Jim Peterson, who had been my boss earlier in my career, and we weren't sure what we should do with it. So Jim Rappanack invented the idea that we needed to go after bigger bales of hay, and so he made me an acquisition director, and we went after the Naval Airship Program, which went for about a year and a half. And then died under the weight of ill wind and the fact that nobody wanted to fly an airbag. So fortunately, that fast forward 20 years, Akron now, who we worked with as a teammate, has now the an unmanned airship that flies at 70,000 feet and a robust business of balloons with radars in them that they're using for defensive purposes. So all of these things we did had some purpose. At the same time, Dick Olson and Rich Howey and Harry Fager, who had just come out of the Air Force, decided that we should bid on a program called Airborne Battlefield Command and Control System. It was AB-CCC-2 at the time, and we had some engineers, John Pernick, who had worked for Rockwell and at the time and had a little bit of knowledge about it. But it was considered a program that we couldn't win. I can remember the marketing take on it was, we've never had a contract with ESC Hanscom. We've never done an airborne command and control job. All the classic checklist of marketing, we failed. So because the airship had folded up, Jim Rappanack asked me to put together an orange team, new concept, which was to look at the design, look at the proposal, and make a decision, because they were having a tough time it kind of made sense to bid it, but the basic marketing instinct was that this was a no bid. But Rich Howey and Dick Olson and these guys had put together a pretty convincing story, and they had a system based on the evolution of a MATCAL system, which was a heavy Navy system in a ship. And of course, I'd just come off of the airship program, so recognizing that if you put 15 of these work consoles out of the MATCALs, that that airplane was never going to get off the ground. So as a part of this Gornsch team, I was given literally 3 days. So I pulled together a crack set of team from marketing, contracts, and engineering, and we took a look at this on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and on Tuesday, made a briefing to the executive staff recommending that we bid this thing, but we had to make some changes and we needed some new technology, and that new technology was kind of in a prototype form, getting prepared for the P3 computers. And it was called a, we ended up calling it was an EDG. So Dave Colling provided some funds for us to go off and look at that solution. Meanwhile, the proposal had got in, we presented it to the customer, and we won a runoff against TRW for a 12-month contract definition phase. We proceeded with a demonstration, writing B specs, et cetera, and won the program. And put in the new EDG concept, and we had a 30-month program. This was one of the first streamlined acquisitions. General McInerney, who worked for us for a time, and you'll see him on Fox News a lot of times. These people were looking at streamlined acquisition, and Tom McInerney was the head of this for DOD. But General Chubb, who was the general up at ESC, had this project, which was scoped out by his people to be a $120 million program, and he only had $50 million. So he invented the concept of fixed-price development with a 3-year warranty, and 80% was good enough, and set us off to work for a 30-month program to produce these 8 capsules. Well, we were successful in producing them, and in the 90 time frame, in August, before Desert Storm started, we rolled two of these off the line. The government flew them successfully, went through their OPIVAL time, did their training, and on the 15th of January, they launched into Kuwait. And we had Fred Swenson, and remember who the
Grossman.
Grossman, the field engineers, and a software guy went to Iraq and flew combat missions and duck scud missiles, and we were on them with the phone solving problems if they had them, backed by SATCOM. So exciting days. It operated with 1,450 hours of combat hours with zero failures, and we received an award along with the military for the local DCAA Northeast section for one of the best programs. MATCALS was also deployed over there as air traffic control in Kuwait, and so we received this dual road of tactical systems for our participation in that. So ABCCC, this is the 90 time frame. So now I'm going to get back to the submarine world a little bit. At that time, Dick McNamara, PEO sub, came in, and they were looking at a program called New SSN, and it was an R&D program to look at the next generation, which turned out to be the Virginia that we're working on today. But in 1990, it was an IRAD program. So Dick Olson was a part of that exercise. Several of the other folks in the building here that worked on that, we put together an IRAD program based upon a pitch that we had given on why couldn't we do a COTS type of radio room for the submarine, as we had done for the ABCCC, as opposed to conventional hard iron. So we did a lot of R&D with the CRAD program with Newick involved, and IBM out of Manassas was involved in the sonar side, and we put together some prototype demonstrations. From our point of view, we had developed a based on what was the name, Ole, of the Steve Anderson's the network that had evolved out of it was basically an Ethernet connection that evolved with a real-time SafeNet. was a SafeNet data link, and which gave you deterministic, like the shin pads did, but it was done with standard Ethernet and compatible. So we had voice over IP working with 5 milliseconds latency, and even today Cisco's trying to get it down to 150 milliseconds latency. So this is another lost opportunity for the now current Lockheed business, that if we'd towed our mark and got in there, we would have been at the front of that network game. But instead, when we put in a proposal for $3 million to write a little, put together a 9-rack radio room, that was accepted by PEO Sub at the time, and we proceeded to put that together. And of course, the Virginia ended up being a 9-rack radio room. At that time, I went back to ABCCC because we had a bunch of PQDI efforts. We put JTIDs on board the ABCCC. We built the first hybrid multi-filter hybrid filter canceller program for the co-site interference for the SINGAR's waveforms, and we had another program with broadcast intel. Which we brought on board all of the tracks from the Intel section, and we're able to integrate those with JTIDs and other data links like SATL, etc. So in the when Kosovo and Bosnia, those wars started, the squadron was deployed, and by this time we're now in a turnkey life cycle mode. We're doing all the work. We're the only contractor working on that job, and doing the life cycle maintenance and doing these upgrades. And so they deployed them to out of Tucson, Davis-Monson Air Force Base, to Aviano, Italy. And this was the longest TDY in Air Force history, because NATO had the ball over in Europe, so they couldn't use our NATO AWACS. JSTARS was not yet mature, so we ended up becoming the airborne command element. If you remember, there was no boots on the ground during that war, so we were the war, and putting in A-10s and doing the precision strikes, etc., with the systems we had. Classic story out of that was, everybody remembers when Scott O'Grady got shot down and spent 8 or 10 days eating grubs because he couldn't communicate with anybody, and he had gotten shot down because the intel folks knew that the guys had moved the missile systems, but ABCCC and the F-16s didn't. So when that was came to light that there was a fix, they created a critical mission need statement, and you had 1 year starting in January to January to produce the countermeasures for the Scott O'Grady fiasco. And so our solution to that, and we got the job again because JSTARS wasn't ready, and so it ended up the little ABCCC program got the con to fix those two problems. So we did two things. They put on the Hook 112 radio, which allowed them to communicate with the guy after he bailed out, and we put in this broadcast intel system that we tied into our battle management system, and we also put in NEMA mapping systems, which gave accurate maps that would show them how to where they really were. If you remember the bombing of the Chinese embassy and some of those, all because they had outdated maps that were on the knee boards of these fighter pilots, and so they were having a lot of difficulties. So bringing the NEMA mapping system on board, the Hook 112 communicator with these guys, and the broadcast intel in real time so they could tell where everybody was. And the next scene, of course, is that the F-117 Lockheed fighter got shot down after a bombing run by a lucky shot, missile shot, by these guys on the ground. But this time things went a little different, better than they did for Scott O'Grady. The guy bailed out. He talked to the gal that was the comm operator on ABCCC all the way down. She knew exactly where he landed. She had him on the very accurate maps, NEMA mapping systems. And when the Marine helicopters came off of the carriers, she was in contact with them. And this is all about, you know, line of sight communications with VHF radios, and we had translators that could convert from these different waveforms, UHF and VHF, because all the NATO guys were all UHF and our fighters were all VHF, so they could translate that back and forth and have data links or intercom links literally with all these people at the same time. So they had the pilot of the helicopter in a direct link talking on a net with the guy on the ground, and the comm operator was able to tell them the helicopter where to land, where the telephone poles were, et cetera, et cetera. So they had him out of there in about 2.5-3 hours. It was all over with versus the 8 days of Scott O'Grady. And again, you know, we received the plaudits for that too, and so that's one of the probably one of the proudest moments of contribution to the warfighter that I had in my career. So this all went along, and we did several more PQ-DI upgrades, and in 2003, the squadron was shut down, the age of the airplanes. We had a last chance with our friends at Lockheed to put this thing together. This is, by this time, Lockheed had merged, bought Loral up, including our legacy companies, and the C-130J was the first ones were rolling off, and we had a congressional plus up to buy seven C-130Js to cross-deck this AB-CCC system and make it go into the next generation. And unfortunately, Trent Lott took some of them for weather birds, and the Pennsylvania Special Operations Force National Guard took the other ones, and so the program was left with old airplanes that were, frankly, wearing out. So in 2003, the system was shut down, and our mission was picked up by the J-STARS folks. So when that shut down, I ended up going back to my roots of command and control, and we had just won Lockheed out of Morristown, had won the CVN-77 total combat system, which was a turnkey CFE combat system to be on the CVN-77 carrier. So thanks to the hard work of Joe Pobiel and Dave Offerman, we ended up with that job. And I moved over as the program manager, and we spent a year doing a definition phase, and we're ready to go on it. The carrier program had been oversold in terms of what they could produce it for, and so the way they cut the cost was to going back to a legacy combat system and a legacy communication system, and so we lost that program, which was another big disappointment for our common radio room thrust, because by this time the Virginia was in full stride and being installed in submarines. The Seawolf was in there. We were doing the production here in the basement of Egan plant, and so this thing was getting good press, and so the marketing folks went out and tried to leverage this into the Ohio class, the Trident class, that had an integrated radio room back in the early 70s that was produced by Camden RCA, and that those guys spun off of L3, so they were the legacy owners. So they obviously wanted to hang on to that, but John Byrne, who was the BD guy on that program, sent in a proposal to Spaywars, which had taken over responsibility for the radio rooms, including the Virginia and whatever, and to do a replacement common submarine radio room based on the Virginia to put on that submarine. So we put in a thing as a turnkey prime, but the government wanted to do this as an in-house operation, so a collaborative team was put together of Spaywar, which is now PMW-770, out of PEOC-4I in space, and Newick, which is our partners on the old Central Computer Complex and the new SSN R&D, etc., as the design agent for all of the radio rooms and submarine classes, and with the production at Charleston. And so that happened in 2003, December. And if you fast forward to today, we have completed the efforts on the Ohio and the Seawolf, and the Virginias are being cranked out with a common radio room on them. We passed successfully in 2007, early 2007, three triple hit OPI valves on the Seawolf and the GN and BN. The common radio room was, there's a variant of four of the Trident submarines that were as part of the SALT talks that we would detune them, and instead of carrying the big missiles, we put a bunch of cruise missiles on them and Special Operations Forces capability, and so slightly different requirements, but basically retrofitting that old RCA L3 system, and that work is ongoing right now. We've reached full rate production, and we're into the stage now. We just received a $54 million sole source contract to maintain and develop this software further. The exciting part of 2007 early is that we got our own business unit back and under Wendy Underwood to pursue this and to try to get this on all of the surface ships, the common radio room. And so that's the thrust we've been working with this year, and we're well positioned for 2008 on a number of programs. 2.5 years ago, we launched on a major program in the radio area for AMF jitters, and we were the prime working for the Navy on a program called Cluster 3. Cluster 3 and Cluster 4 were merged together to a program called AMF jitters and JTRS. And now, after 2 years of being on contract, we won that program. And after 2 years of being on contract in a parallel shootout with Boeing and another mega team, are positioned for a win in February of 2008. And that'll kind of round out our capabilities in terms of the radio rooms, the radios, and get Lockheed on the path to being the supplier of choice for communications and networks that'll provide warfighter internet to the warfighter. And I think that's the end of my story, Ole. Do you have anything to add, Quentin?
Well, the only thing, this is Quint Eckert, and I came to work here at what was then Sperry Univac in 67 after almost 10 years in the U.S. Navy. As far as, I'll just address the submarine business a little bit. Some of the things that Larry didn't mention is 688 was truly the first integrated combat system on a submarine. It was also the first multiprocessing system. Some of the other firsts there. When we started with the UX-7, we had a 48K word machine. We had over 650,000 words of software that needed to run in that system. We, in order to overcome the problem, invented a thing called DMR, Dynamic Module Replacement, which the world knows today, excuse me, as roll-in, roll-out. We had software that rolled in and out as far as the TMA algorithms on a 15-second basis. We had software that needed to be responsive to the operator when he wanted to do a manual target motion analysis, a thing called MATE. So we were rolling in, rolling out, data filtering, data initialization, the Kalman filter program, as well as rolling in and rolling out. The other part of that software was the navigation system, the dual inertial miniature navigation system. We had to roll in out software there. A critical requirement of the system was that we be able to tolerate failures and recover within 3 5/8 seconds without loss of data, or we were up to 30 hours away from navigational accuracy. We implemented that. It was the first system that I know of that recovered from memory, CPU, I/O, individual channel failures, as well as peripheral failures, and did all of those recoveries both with and without data loss, depending on the operational mode. We also had a casualty mode where we rolled in a reduced capability program, which allowed the operator to run the diagnostic while the operational program was going. Again, another first. Nobody had ever produced any system with that capability. The other thing that we did there, Larry mentioned his name, Tom Weisenberger, told me years after the fact that he and the Navy thought we were crazy for signing up to do the job, particularly when we signed up to do a 100-hour mission, both under simulation and actual on the boat. 100-hour test, exercising all facets of the system, including casualty recovery. And in that test, we had periods of free play where there was no scripted test procedure. The sailors were allowed to come in and do as they pleased with the system. We passed all of those tests with no problem. The only other thing, I'll jump up to Fog Cutter a little bit and mention that Fog Cutter went aboard Trepang twice. It went aboard first and was at sea for a normal patrol, came back, the equipment was taken off of the boat, was brought back here for some refurbishment, went out to Newark in Pasadena where we installed everything in racks, tested it out, took it back to New London, installed it in Trepang again. The system performed throughout that mission, and it was on that last mission when during a personnel transfer, the conning officer of the boat slowed down a little bit too rapidly with the hatch open for the personnel transfer, and the following weight came down through the hatch, and as Larry said, when the 1616 came back, it was fully salt encrusted. But after washing out, it went to work again. As a matter of fact, the computer got washed out, dried out. They put power to it, and it came up running the program that had initially been there. And I think I'll just stop there and write the rest of it up.
Okay, well, I appreciate you guys coming by today, and this will be the end of our formal recording.
Okay, thank you.